Hello, I'm Matt Ringrose, and welcome to Very Vedic. I'm going to be answering the questions we all have about life today using the oldest wisdom on the planet, the ancient Vedic texts from India, the Vedas. They were written over 6,000 years ago with one purpose, to help us. This knowledge has the potential to free us from suffering and allow us to live our fullest lives. And that's why I created Very Vedic, to share it with you. I'm a Vedic meditation teacher and the founder of Bondi Meditation Center. And this season, I'm joined by my student, Anna. If you're keen to learn how to meditate, or you have a question you'd like answered, DM me on Instagram at Bondi Meditation, or email info@bondimeditation.com.au. Okay, here we go. Hello, Anna.
Hello, Matt.
How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And we are already, would you believe, at our final episode of the second season.
It's come around fast.
Yeah, so I'm pretty pumped for this one. I'm
Me too.
Hoping you've got some good questions. Well, I know
do.
You will have.
Well, I've been thinking about the podcast we did last time on manifestation. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how our thoughts and beliefs determine our reality. And I was wondering, what about speech? Can we manifest things through the way that we speak?
Ah, okay, yeah. So manifestation and speech, that's a good one to explore. Yeah, we have that thing, don't we, where we say something and we catch ourselves and say, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I'll make it happen. Yeah?
Mm.
But is that really true? Can we really make things happen just by saying them? Well, the Veda says that yes, that can be true, but it's dependent on our state of consciousness, as these things tend to be. So as we discussed in the last episode, consciousness has infinite resources. So it can manifest anything at any time. But obviously not everything everyone says manifests. Otherwise, people would have worked that out a long time ago and just say, oh, I'm about to win the lottery, and it would happen. See what I mean?
Yeah.
There'd be total chaos of manifestation. Somebody might say it's going to rain and it would rain. And then the next moment, someone say it's going to be sunny and it would suddenly be sunny and so on. So we'd have very changeable weather, very changeable everything, be chaos. So there's so many people on the planet, there has to be a hierarchy of manifestation through speech. And this hierarchy is based on states of consciousness, according to the Veda. So there's a statement in the Veda that says, first a rishi speaks, then it becomes true. A rishi is a seer, so someone in a high state of consciousness. So the Veda is saying that the higher someone's state of consciousness, the more likely their words are to be borne out in reality. This is because the more conscious we become, the more our intention and the universe's intention converge, become the same. That's what the journey to enlightenment is. It's a convergence of individuality with universality. So what we want, what we value and feel drawn towards as individuals becomes aligned with the universe's agenda. So our thoughts and actions and words will reflect that. So the statement, first the rishi speaks, then it becomes true, isn't really about the rishi manifesting anything personally, so much as being an agent for universal intent. The universe is speaking through them, and the universe will always manifest its intent. Therefore, what they say becomes true. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the rishi can be us. The more our consciousness grows and we understand this kind of knowledge, the more rishi-like we become, the more we're aligned with the universe, and bit by bit, our speech is refined and what we say becomes true.
Okay, so not everyone's speech manifests reality then. So some people's speech has no power at all to manifest?
The fact is, everyone's speech plays some part in manifesting their reality. As we've said many times in this series, it's become almost like the catchphrase of the series, what we put our attention on grows. And speech is a means of giving attention to something and enlivening that thing. So whilst what we say might not directly manifest in an obvious way, by constantly putting our attention on, say, something negative through our speech, we reinforce certain energies, certain thought patterns, values, beliefs, expectations. And this suppresses the expansion of our consciousness. negative traits of speech have the effect of suppressing us and suppressing others so we don't meet our potential. But if we can become aware of these traits of speech and remove or refine them, we can have the effect of actually uplifting or expanding our own consciousness and the consciousness of others through our speech. So there's a lot at stake when we speak. So we should probably talk about ways we can refine it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Well, speech is so powerful because we can use it to create, maintain, or destroy. And the usual Vedic guidance applies here, which is that we should be looking to enliven its capacity to create, with maintenance secondary, and minimize how much we use it to destroy. And it's very easy to slip into the habits of using speech in a destructive way, even if that's not necessarily our intention. So when I say we want to use speech creatively, what I mean is we want to use it to unite, to create unity and to remove fear, to bring about shared experience. Think about, for example, when we have a friend who's struggling and we're trying to help them by talking to them. This is language being used in a creative form. And it has the effect of supporting. It allows love to flow. It breaks down defensiveness and fear, builds trust, brings hope, all those good things. And these are the kind of qualities we want to enliven in our speech. Now, obviously, we'll be in lots of different situations, not always with our best friends, and the words we use will vary infinitely depending on the situation we find ourselves in. But the intention of our approach should remain consistent regardless of the challenge. The Vedic view is that we are all part of the one same thing, all connected and interreliant, and ultimately all on the same team. So at the level of intention, we're always looking where possible to enliven a sense of unity, shared experience, and the removal of fear with our speech. Intention is the place to start, as it's the source of all speech, the intention to be compassionate and empathetic. So that's what we want to work towards. But obviously, easier said than done, it can be very easy to inadvertently weaponize speech and use it destructively. We're seeing pretty clear examples of that right now in the run-up to the US election, with language being used, you know, very kind of strategically to stoke division in the interests of power. And that's an obvious example. But we do it ourselves, and maybe more than we'd like to admit. If we get into an argument, or if we're triggered in some way, the destructive little voice in our head tells us to say things that will actually make matters worse and cause more separation between us and the person in question. Or more subtly, we might say things in general conversation that push someone down to make ourselves look better, maybe, through comparison. We might gossip or stir the pot to turn people against each other, blame people, that kind of thing. And these are all things we've probably all done at some point, if we're honest, and they're totally normalized uses of language in today's society, but they're all examples of destructive language. So it's about having an awareness of when our intention might start to slip more towards focusing on the difference rather than unity, on destruction rather than creation.
Okay, can you give us some tips around moving away from destructive speech into creative speech?
Yeah, like a top five speech tips?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see how we go. Well, the first thing to do, like we've just been saying, is to become aware of any destructive traits in our speech. When you're about to say something, but you look at it in like the departure lounge of your mind and see that if you do say it, it will cause further separation or push someone down or put attention on something negative, then just stop talking. Don't say it. Even if it means stopping in the middle of a sentence and actually saying, actually, you know what? I'm not going to say that. Or simply shutting up. That's a really top tip. Stopping mid-negative flow. And this goes for any kind of inauthentic speech as well. When you're about to say something or you're saying something that doesn't really express what you feel, take a pause, become a witness to what's happening instead. That was a Maharishi Mahesh Yogi tip. Another top tip, which is like a subject in itself, is the idea of worthy inquiry. And this is the thing that unless someone asks for your advice or knowledge, don't give it to them. So don't vomit up unsolicited advice. You'll probably have noticed that sometimes when you're giving someone advice, it doesn't feel good. It kind of feels a bit dry. It doesn't quite flow. That's probably because there wasn't any worthy inquiry. If someone asks your opinion or gives you some kind of invitation to give them your perspective, then give them a little bit and let them ask for more. Don't overwhelm them with everything you know on the subject. If they keep asking questions, then keep dosing them with more information. That's a healthy way to give out wisdom. Otherwise, you're just annoying and they won't apply the guidance anyway, and you'll probably alienate them in some way. Okay, what else? Don't invalidate someone else's experience. This is a good one. Everyone's reality is real and true in their state of consciousness. So the starting point, even if you want to assist or change someone's experience, is to first accept their reality of experience. And from that place of unity, they'll be much more likely to take your guidance. Don't tell them what they're experiencing isn't real. That won't help anyone. Another one is notice when you're on repeat, when what you're saying starts to lose its aliveness through repetition. That feeling of deadness in the speech is showing you something. It's showing you that what you're saying is irrelevant. You're diminishing rather than increasing the value of the thing by telling everyone about it. And if you examine it further, you'll probably find that the repetition is actually coming from a place of lack or fear anyway. So look for something fresh and creative to say instead, or don't say anything, probably even better sometimes. How many is that? Four? Okay, final one of the five, stop moaning. Resist the temptation to keep saying how crap you feel, as that may reinforce that reality and make it last longer than it needs to. Obviously, we can ask for help, but if we're just reinforcing our status constantly with our speech, it's better not to say anything, to remain silent. Again, our favorite law of nature, what we put our attention on grows. So our state is likely to last longer because we're reinforcing it through our speech. So there's a few, not sure if it's a definitive top five, but all those things have helped me have a better experience in some way or other. So in summary, we want to be communicating what we really mean. And that might sound like an obvious thing to say, but when you start to observe your own speech, you might see room for improvement. You want to culture a pure intention and to communicate that intention as clearly as possible.
Do you think that it's true that sometimes when like people moan or, you know, gossip, they do it because it feels like a stress release?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. We do it because it feels like a stress release. Whether it actually releases any stress is another matter though. I just want to make the distinction that we're talking about pure moaning here rather than looking for help. And David Hawkins says, when we moan, we get that relief of temporary decompression as the stress settles down, only for all the stress to rise up again, just as big or bigger, next time it's triggered. So by moaning, we're actually suppressing the stress and missing our opportunity to release it. And what we could do instead is use Hawkins' letting go technique, where we feel the feeling rather than avoiding the feeling by moaning. I mean, it's natural to moan. We all have our moments, but I think it's interesting to understand the mechanics of it and see what it's actually doing.
Okay. That's good. Because I think sometimes in the moment it does feel like, it does feel like you're releasing it, but it's good to note that probably if it won't actually be releasing it if you take a step back. So it sounds like you kind of need to be quite vigilant while you're practicing this.
It does sound a bit like that, doesn't it? And it sounds a little bit like speech is going to become very unspontaneous. But I think having a general awareness and having the sense that you're going to do a bit of a spring clean of your speech can be, you know, quite an enjoyable process. You'll just start to highlight those things you want to remove. You'll notice them. And as I said at the start, the stakes are so high because if we get our speech right, not only will we uplift our own consciousness, but we can uplift the consciousness of others around us.
Can you talk about being vulnerable with your speech?
Tell me a bit more what you mean, Anna.
Like, have you heard Brené Brown, The Power of Vulnerability?
Mm-hmm.
If someone says, you know, how's your day? How you going? Classic Aussie thing. How you going, mate? You're like, well, I'm actually having a really shit day, but I'm not going to tell you that. So, yeah, I'm great. Thanks. Or I'm good.
Yeah.
But is that a lie? And in those moments, should you be vulnerable?
Well, it's funny you should ask if that's a lie. Just the whole idea of lying is interesting. And the Vedic view on it is that it's not that lying is always bad. This may surprise you to hear. So the Vedic view is that you can say something which isn't strictly true if it's in the interests of evolution. So for example, if a child was very scared and said to you, oh, daddy or mummy, can you promise me that nobody will ever hurt us in our family? Nobody's ever going to come into the house and hurt us. You wouldn't answer and say, well, statistically, there is a chance, James, that, you know, that a murderer will come in here. It's slim, but it's possible. No, you'd say, probably. No, James, we're all safe here. You're totally safe and everyone's fine and everyone's going to be okay. And that's because this is the most evolutionary thing to say. To plant a neurosis in a child who's not in a position to have a context or ability to understand that or respond to that information, that could actually end up holding back their evolution, you see. So sometimes white lies are allowed.
How do you use your discernment to know when it's allowed?
By tuning into your fine level of feeling. And that's an idea we've spoken about several times in this series. It means that you connect to and are guided by nature's intelligence. And nature's intelligence's specialist subject is what's most evolutionary. That's the basis on which it guides us. That's charm. That's the charm signal. The charm signal is showing us what's most evolutionary. So in any situation where we're deciding, for example, if the truth or a white lie is the right thing to say, that fine level of feeling will give you an accurate cognition around that. It's all about the intention to deceive. Are we intending to deceive somebody? Or are we using language in a way which isn't technically accurate to bring about shared experience?
So you've given an example with a child, and I understand that because children, like I understand the need to protect a child's mind at such a young age. But can you give an example of a time where you might, what do you call it, like tell a white lie to an adult?
Yeah. So let's look at the classic example. You get the pair of socks or the jumper at Christmas from your mum. And you're like, oh God, I'm never going to wear that. Shocker. But do you say that to your mum? No, you say, oh, thanks, mum. That's lovely. Thanks for thinking of me and all that kind of stuff. So the thing is there, it's not an intention to deceive, which is the dominant factor. It's an intention to create shared experience and a flow of love. So there's an example of where telling the truth might not be as virtuous as we always think it is.
Could it be about, again, what you were talking about with the picking up the high note of a conversation? You kind of like you're picking up, you're focusing your attention on maybe the things that actually you do like about that gift. So maybe the initial reaction is like, ugh, I will never wear this. But then when you actually look at it, you can, with your attention, actually have gratitude for parts of that gift.
The jumper I have in my mind, that would be stretching it to actually wear it. But no, you're exactly right. That's a beautiful observation, Anna. What you're putting your attention on, what you're validating is the soma, the attention, consideration, love that the gift represents from your mum, rather than the fact that it's going to be a, you know, a useful addition to the wardrobe.
Yeah. It's kind of like it's about not being brutally honest, which is going to cause separation.
Yes. The idea, I think the clue is in the term there. If somebody's being brutally honest, that probably sounds like it's bringing about some collateral damage. Rather than be brutally honest, we'd rather speak the sweet truth. And this is another way of saying that we want to validate the high end. The sweet truth is that part of reality which contains the things we want to put our attention on and want to grow, the higher qualities.
Yeah. Can you talk about why some conversations are so satisfying and then some are really not?
This is a good one. Yeah. So this is because there are different levels of consideration and experience of life. And depending on our state of consciousness and the other person's state of consciousness, how many of those layers we share will determine how satisfying that conversation is for us. I will elaborate. So from the Vedic view, there are three levels of consideration. They have Vedic terms, but I'll try not to use those and instead just describe the layers. So one layer of experience, consideration, is the surface layer. You know, the layer of things, actions, what's happening. Like we're both sitting on the couch here recording a podcast. The second layer is the layer in which something is to be learned, something which will move us closer to the feet of God, something which will allow us to become more enlightened. And there's always that opportunity in every moment if we can find that layer. And the third layer is the layer of oneness, the layer of consideration, which has within it the understanding that everything is one thing. Now, what you'll notice is that most of the world deals on the surface layer. And you'll meet a friend who, let's just say, and I don't want to start sounding all elitist and separatist here, but let's just say that they're not, you know, working on expanding their consciousness, and they have a preoccupation with and an interest in really only the surface layer. So they'll be telling you about, you know, where they went for dinner, how so-and-so's bought a new house, etc. But there won't be much of a sense in their language, in their conversation, for those other two layers. Now, when we learn to meditate and our consciousness starts to expand, the second and third layers, so that's to say the layer in which there's something to be learned, some way of growing and evolving, the teaching available in every moment, and also the layer on which everything is ultimately one thing, those layers start to become enlivened and you start to become interested in them. And conversations where you're just, as it were, playing the one note, the surface layer note, start to be less satisfying than the chord, which has all three notes in it. And so naturally, we can start to find conversations either satisfying with people where we're, you know, we have that connection on at least two or maybe three of those levels, and less satisfaction in purely superficial conversations. It's not that we lose interest in or disregard the surface layer. We don't want to disregard any of the layers of consideration or reality. But we no longer feel satisfied just to talk about the surface level of things. We enjoy conversations more when they're informed by some understanding of the underlying determinants, those hidden forces that actually shape the surface layer. You know, a deeper understanding of what's going on under the surface.
So even if, you know, that person you were communicating with was only communicating on that surface layer, but you know about that those three layers, does that mean a conversation could never actually be satisfying? Because you're seeing so much more, you're experiencing so much more depth within that interaction.
It comes back to another principle of speech and general communication, Vedic communication, which is that we validate the high end. We validate that part, or we put our attention on that part of the interaction, which does have unity. So we don't put our attention on what's absent. And this will give us a better chance to at least experience some unity and some satisfaction.
Do you think that if you are acknowledging those three layers, you will enliven something within the other person, even if they weren't to begin with?
Yes, we can uplift others with our speech and with our conscious presence, but within the limitations of that person's conscious potential. And you'll soon get a feel for where those limitations lie. And there's also this idea with this kind of thing of not crossing the streams, which is an old, possibly redundant Ghostbusters analogy. The idea is we don't want to talk to somebody from a level of reality that they're not experiencing, as this will probably end up creating more separation, bewilderment, and probably alienating the person. So if somebody comes to you, for example, asking for some relationship advice, and they're not particularly interested in raising their state of consciousness or in this kind of way of looking at the world, then you're probably best off advising them on the surface level of things rather than trying to tell them how everything's all one and how there's something to be learned in every moment. That probably won't be as effective as actually working with the person on the level of reality that they actually experience.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's like a foreign language.
Can we practice working on the other two levels that you're talking about, below the surface level?
Yes, we can. There's a Vedic technique that my teacher Tom Knowles taught me called 3-in-1. And this is where, in any situation, we try to have the three layers alive simultaneously in our awareness. And this is a kind of a manual, formal practice to do to start to stimulate our experience of, you know, the more subtle layers of reality. But eventually, this will become automatic. We'll automatically have that symphonic understanding or appreciation of life where all three layers are all simultaneously operating within us.
Can you give an example of how we would practice that?
Okay, yeah, let's just try and apply this idea to, or these three layers of consideration to a random example. Let's say you're going to catch a plane and you miss the plane. So, on the surface level of that situation, you've missed a plane. And you may have to, it may cost you money and all those things. Then we have the second level of consideration, which is the way in which this experience can deliver some opportunity for us to grow, to expand our consciousness, to get closer to the divine. And that's that second layer. And on that level, missing a plane may be an opportunity to surrender and to accept that there is a certain plan or path for you, which does not always meet your expectations, but which is optimized to provide you the greatest opportunities for growth and fulfillment. So there's a lesson available and a learning and a growth available on that level. And on the level of oneness, nothing is personal. Nothing is punishment. Everything is the play and balancing of different forces. The missing of the flight was in some way relevant to the functioning of the overall organism. So in this biggest perspective, you're not the victim. You're just playing a necessary role in the tapestry of life. And you can choose how you want to play that role. You can, you know, kick up a fuss, or you can play the role gracefully, knowing that everything is actually just as it should be.
Okay, so I want to kind of take the conversation in a very different direction now.
Okay.
And it's going to involve the G word, God.
Okay, yeah.
Which I think that sometimes it's easy to beat around the bush of the God word. But I just want to know, like, do you believe in God? And what's, if so, what's your relationship with God?
Yes, I do believe in my idea of God. So, yeah, the word God is triggering for a lot of people. Is it triggering for you?
Not for me, but I'm aware that it is for a lot of people.
Yeah, people associate it with organized religion and all that that stands for in the modern perception. So patriarchy and dogma, abuse of power, the main reason for wars, guilt, all that stuff. So I suppose, not surprisingly, God has a bit of an image problem. So I'll just define what I mean when I say I believe in God. What I'm referring to is that underlying creative intelligence that conceives, constructs, and governs the world we live in. For me, it's undeniable that there's some intelligence that organizes all of this. I don't believe or feel that what we see around us here is a result of chaos and random chance. There are observable, intelligent patterns flowing through and balancing the whole thing. So even on the level of the intellect, the existence of some supreme intelligence much bigger than myself seems obvious to me. Like even just the fact that there are 6 trillion processes a second happening in my body, each perfectly balanced and aligned with all the others, is enough to make that clear to me. But going deeper than the intellect, what I've experienced as I've meditated twice a day for over a decade is an increasing direct experience of that creative intelligence. Through this meditation and this knowledge, I've started to become aware of something that is in everything, something the same. So it started quite quickly for me. I learned to meditate, and within a month or two, I stopped getting the train into work in the city and started walking the 6-kilometer walk every day, just so I could look at the trees along the way. Because the trees were the first things I started to sense having this quality about them. There was something I recognized in them, which I also had in me. They had more aliveness, and there was, or than I was used to trees having, and there was this connection between me and them. And when I put my attention on them, they reciprocated this attention back to me. So, like a kind of sense of unity or relationship with them. And I was definitely keeping this to myself at the time. I was running a call center, and so not the kind of thing you'd be talking about around the water fountain. But I started noticing it in other things as well. The shop signs, the wrought iron fences, they had this same quality of reciprocal aliveness in them as well. And it was totally thrilling, like a kind of whole new world was emerging. And this is God for me. I've referred to it with lots of different words throughout the series, like you say, nature, consciousness, being, the divine, because try not to alienate anyone who gets triggered by the word God. But what I've always been referring to is that energy which creates, flows through, and is the essence of everything. And as I continue to meditate, these experiences got more pronounced and more stabilized. So now I can experience them all the time. And that changes things, because you can no longer hide from the truth when you're seeing it all the time. And the truth is that everything is divine, everything has its place and is perfect in its own way. And everything is interrelated. And when that penny drops, that's transformational. The fear levels go down and the love levels go up. And as I said before, the need for defensiveness falls away, and you generally just want to be more of a team player. So obviously that's what I decided to do with my life from that point onwards.
Yeah, creating a new image of God seems really important. Like, rather than being in one body or in one place, God's everywhere.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so what do we do to enliven these experiences for ourselves? Is it just time and meditation?
Yeah, first things first, you need to do a powerful meditation practice regularly. And as you know, I recommend Vedic meditation. It needs to be a powerful, effective meditation to enhance your perception so that you can start to detect the divine quality in things. How long this takes will vary from person to person, but it will inevitably start to arise if you practice Vedic meditation twice every day, for example. You might already experience what I'm talking about, or it might already be a little bit there as a potential in your perception that you haven't, you know, really put your attention on yet. So as you listen to this, look around you and put your attention on something. It could be something natural. It could be something man-made. And as you put your attention on that thing, can you feel its attention on you being enlivened in response? Can you feel some sense of reciprocation from the thing? Is there some sense of it showing you its essence? If that's a big no, you don't really sense this, then there's a little game I like to play with myself where I look at the thing and ask, what's nature's intention? As in, what's nature's intention for manifesting this thing? Because everything is an expression of nature's intention, right? So by having that inner inquiry, what's nature's intention? When I look at something, I find that nature brings its intention with that thing to the foreground. It shows me its perfection, and I feel a swelling of love in the heart for basically anything that I do this with.
I've been trying to practice that technique that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, where you look at something and you go, what's nature's intention for this? And it kind of frustrates me because I feel it with some things and in some situations. I feel it, you know, in nature, particularly in a strong way. But in that example, I was looking at the air conditioning up there yeah. and I don't feel it. Uh-huh. Okay. And I think it's because it's man-made.
A lot of people have this same experience you're describing. We often find it easier to detect the divine quality of something when it's a pure, unfiltered expression of nature. For example, a tree or a flower or a mountain or the sea. But when that creation has manifested via a human nervous system, some of that divinity can feel like it's been filtered out, like with an air conditioning unit, for example. Not the most natural thing, and possibly even a violation of some laws of nature in some way, in that it uses lots of electricity, disrupts the ecosystem and all that. But then some things that are created via a human nervous system do feel like pure expressions of nature, like the most beautiful art and music. And again, in these, perhaps we can detect the divine more easily. It's closer to our experience of like a tree or a flower. But if you're still struggling to find that connection to detect the divine in things, there are places where the divine finds it harder to hide itself than it does in others, or some places. And this is in any kind of phase transition, any kind of boundary land in time or space. So, for example, at dawn, as the sun rises, where the froth of the sea meets the sand on the shore, the sight of a pregnant woman or a newborn child, or a process of death or dying. In these kind of transitional places and things, the illusion is thinner and doesn't obscure the divine quality of life so much.
So you said in these transitional phases, nature finds it harder to hide itself. So is the connotation or the implication there that nature's trying to hide itself at other times?
Yeah, the whole of creation and our journey to enlightenment is a game of hide and seek. The thing is, everything is God. We are God. And yet, most of the time, if not all of the time, we can't see it or him or her. We get a glimpse here and there, but generally, the divine is hiding from us. And through our meditation practice, through knowledge like this, we start to get clues, hints, and directions, and an increased capacity through perception to see God more often. And eventually, the end of the journey is that we discover that not only is God in all things, but actually we are God observing our own creation.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's nothing like going out on a high note. So I think that might be the end of the series.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to end for now. I just wanted to say thank you, Anna, and to everyone who's listened to these podcasts. I loved the first series. I wasn't sure about doing the second series, but I've doubly enjoyed the second series. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Matt. I've learnt a lot.
Great. Okay, we'll see you again soon. Lots of love and Jai Guru Dev.
Jai Guru Dev.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Very Vedic, produced by Liam Gordon, with original music by Al Royale. If you have a question you'd like to ask, or if you'd like to learn to meditate, DM me at Bondi Meditation on Instagram, or email me at info@bondimeditation.com.au. We'll be back with another episode soon. Until then, Jai Guru Dev.